Permit System Committee. And we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2003 and ask Dave to come forward from Legislative Council and go through the Dash 6 amendments.
Chair Canope, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. You should have before you Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2003. The amendments are pretty much a gotten stuff, so my comments will be directed to the sections as they appear in the amendments and to the page numbers as they appear in the amendments. The first three pages have a lengthy preamble, and I'm not going to spend too much time on that, but move straight to the meat of the bill. On page 3, section 1, are amendments to ORS 238-200, and consistent with what House Bill 2003 had originally contained, this and the next two sections would eliminate the 6% employee contribution to the PERS system. Unlike 2003, it is immediate and completely eliminated as of July 1st, 2003. This means, and this is for both Tier 1 and Tier 2 members, and it means that for people hired on or after July 1st, 2003, those people will not have an employee account in PERS. I will mention at some point during the presentation a little bit about connecting this with any successor plan that may be adopted, because by the nature of this bill, there is some pieces that could link in with any future successor plan for purposes of new hires. But at least under the bill as it now stands, the bill does not contemplate that there will be a successor plan. It merely indicates that for people hired on and after July 1st, 2003, they will not have employee accounts, which means that the benefit of those members would be under the defined contribution calculation that's provided in 238-200. So the effect for those people is essentially to say there will not be a defined contribution calculation for your benefit. You will receive the defined benefit calculation in 238-200. So that is sections 1 and 2. Section 3 would eliminate contributions to the variable annuity account commencing immediately on July 1st, 2003. This would mean that members, some of whom are currently putting in 25, 50, or 75% of their PERS contribution into the variable annuity account, will no longer be doing that. The other change that's made for the variable annuity account is the prohibition on transferring funds from your regular accounts to the variable annuity account, and that's effective after June 30th, 2003. You'd not be able to transfer to the variable annuity. So in effect, this means that there are no more contributions to transfer over to the variable annuity, because there are no contributions to the regular account, and it would also prohibit transferring your regular account, any of the amounts in your regular account, over to the variable account after June 30th, 2003. If there are any questions on that, I'd be happy to respond. Much of that is similar to what was in 2003 as originally published, the major difference being that it is immediate. July 1st, 2003, it was phased in, and the bill was originally published.
So, Dave, members would still have money in their variable account. They just couldn't add any more, essentially?
That is correct. To the extent they are in the variable, they will remain in the variable. That they have money there, it will stay there. It also means for the regular account exactly the same thing, that Tier 1 and Tier 2 members hired before July 1st, to the extent they have money in their regular accounts on July 1st, it stays there. Section 5 relates to the manner in which Tier 1 members' accounts will be credited, and this is the 8%, the so-called 8% guarantee, the guarantee that accounts will be credited with the assumed interest rate. The provisions, the amendments that are made by the bill to 238.255 in Section 5 basically indicate that there will not be any crediting of earnings to Tier 1 member accounts as long as there's a deficit in the reserve account. The reserve account currently has a substantial deficit because of amounts that were paid at 8%, crediting of 8% in the last 2 years, during which there were not earnings to fund that crediting. And so subsection 2, the new subsection 2 that appears on page 16, would in essence say that as long as there's a deficit, there will not be crediting to anything above 0%. The members do not, nothing will be taken out of the account. If the earnings are less than 0%, there's no provision that says that they can take money out of the account to reflect the loss. But until there's earnings above 0% and the deficit account is paid off, there will not be any crediting to those accounts. Under the existing law, the board has always credited the assumed interest rate, currently 8%. The other thing that happens under the language of subsection 2 is that the board is prohibited from crediting earnings to Tier 1 member accounts in any year if that crediting results in a deficit in the reserve account. What that is saying is, let's assume that last year the fund, let's assume this year that the fund earned enough, or next year better yet, earned enough to completely wipe out the deficit. So that in the coming year we're starting from 0%. If the next year the fund earned, say, 4%, the board could only credit Tier 1 accounts to the extent that a new deficit wasn't created. So if the board decided to credit 5%, that would create a deficit. The effect of that language is to basically say that you cannot have crediting of earnings in any year if the effect of that crediting would be to create a deficit. Once the reserves are reestablished and are in place, to the extent that the reserves can pay off, there could be up to the 8% underneath the existing structure. Because as long as the crediting doesn't result in a deficit, you can go ahead and pay it up to the 8%. And if the requirements that were imposed under House Bill 2001, you remember we've already amended the statute, if those conditions are met, it could even go beyond 8%. So it does leave the possibility of more than 8% if those conditions are met. The other thing that's happened in 238.255 is the elimination of the five-year call. That occurs on lines 1 to 3 on page 16. As you know, the existing law indicates that the deficit deficit reserve that's established for the guarantee of the assumed interest rate can only be maintained for a period of 5 years. There's been a lot of debate about what happens at the end of that 5 years, about what the result is. If it that automatically then becomes a employer obligation, et cetera. By the removal of this language, the deficit can be maintained indefinitely and would continue to be paid with the earnings on the fund. So that's a significant change that needs to be pointed out. The deletion of that one sentence eliminates the five-year call. Any questions on crediting the 8%? Section 8 establishes a minimum account balance for Tier 1 members. And what this does is say that a Tier 1 member, and this is going to vary from member to member, but a Tier 1 member, when they come to retirement time and you look at their account balance, that they cannot have less than the amount they would have had if during the career of the member their account had been credited with the assumed interest rate in each year. Now, for most members at this point, having had the crediting that was done in the late 90s, their accounts, of course, have far more at this point than what they would have received with just the straight assumed interest rate. This section ties back into the previous section, which is basically saying that until the deficit goes away, the Tier 1 members won't get credited anything. And if that went on for some period of time, or if undercrediting less than 8% went on for some substantial period of time, what Section 8 says is that when you get to your end of your career, at the very least, no matter what your account balance shows at this time, that it will be credited as having at least the amount you would have had if during your entire career it had been credited with the assumed interest rate. So, as you know, the assumed interest rate has changed over time. That may mean for some members some period of time crediting at 7.5 or even at lower amounts for long-term employees. But at the very least, your account balance will have to have the amount that it would have had if it had always been credited with the assumed interest rate. Is that any questions on that particular piece? Section 10 relates to retired members. It's on page 17. Section 10 is addressed to the crediting that occurred in 1999 when Tier 1 accounts were credited with, I believe, 20%. I believe that's the number. And the effect, what Section 10 basically does is tells the retirement board to look at the retirement allowance received by any person who retired on or after February 1st, 2000, which would have been the first retirees who received a benefit from the 1999 crediting, and that any member who retired before February 1st, 2004, and to determine for those particular retirees what their retirement allowance would have been if their accounts had been credited with earnings for calendar year 1999 of 11.33%. And I don't have all of the factors that went into play with the 11.33. Other than that, I know that if there were assumptions with respect to, one of the key assumptions there was if the board had credited the reserves for the 8% guarantee to the full amount that they had established as the amount they wanted to have as reserves. As you may remember from earlier presentations, the board elected not to fully fund the reserves, but to only put in part of what they had determined was needed by way of reserves. The 11.33 in part reflects a full crediting of the amount that the board had determined to be the amount needed for protection in the event of a downturn in the market. The other piece I know that went into it was an assumption that the contingency reserve was fully funded. That's the reserve that we amended extensively last session in one of the bills that passed through relating to PERS. And beyond that, I believe those were the two key components of arriving at the 11.33. What the Section 10 then tells the board is saying, now that you've determined what their retirement allowance would have been if it had been credited with that, to basically take that monthly amount, go ahead and add on COLAs as though they're 2% or whatever it may be. If it's 2% right now, and probably will be for quite a long time because of what's called banking, that go ahead and start figuring how that would grow with a 2% increase. And what it says is for those members who retired during this period of time, that they will continue to receive what they're receiving on July 1st, 2003, but they will not receive any COLA increases thereafter. So they're basically, the amount they're receiving on July 1st is frozen at that point, and it will continue to remain frozen until that other retirement allowance, the one based on the assumption of 11.33 credit in 1999, because of the COLA increases, goes above that figure and begins to move up, and then they will start moving back up again and start receiving the COLAs based on that amount. And for different employees, it will take longer for that to happen. It's sort of like the look-back provision we had on the mortality tables. In fact, it's very similar sort of mechanism. Freezes the benefit for a period of time until this other calculation catches up, at which point it will begin to, again, they'll start receiving COLAs on the amount that they are receiving on July 1st. This is a complicated one, so if anybody wants to ask any questions.
Thank you.
Representative Barker.
I had a call from a constituent who falls into this group, and he said, unlike the stories you're hearing about people making way over the 100% of salary for retirement, he's getting about half, 50% of his salary. He said, I'm too old, and other personal reasons, he can't seek other employment. He said, when I walked out the door with the promise of a certain amount of money, including those 2%, if the inflation reached 2%. He said, I may not have retired had I known I couldn't get those because I'm going to need those dollars. What am I going to tell him? I mean, I understand there's we talk about a question of fairness and having those people who retired pay that back, but this is not a statistical case. This is a real person. And was he promised that he would get 2% when he walked out the door? Was he told that's what he had coming?
Chair Canope, Representative Barker, that is what the current statute on the COLA indicates occurs for retirees. The thought on the COLA freeze is that there was no desire to reduce the pensions of anybody who had retired, which is what would happen if you would go back and say, take the money back that was credited in 1999. That would result in an immediate decline in the monthly benefits payable to those people. PERS does have mechanisms for recovering overpayments. And there is an assumption here, of course, that the 1999 constituted an overpayment. That is true. And that is something which eventually the courts will decide whether or not that was in fact true or not. Because if there wasn't an overpayment for 1999, if the board was okay in doing that, if that was valid, then at that point, recovering those amounts through this mechanism would become problematic at best. So all of these things, I think, raise significant legal questions. There's no question about it. Almost everything in this bill raises significant legal questions. Some of them relate to the bigger question. Most of them relate to a bigger question, which is can you change the benefit structure midstream during a career so long as you protect accrued benefits? This one here is a narrower question than that bigger one because it's looking back at a specific board decision, the crediting of the accounts in 1999. And, of course, in the Lipscomb decision in the Marion County case, that decision held that, in fact, that the crediting in 1999 was too much. I mean, the Lipscomb decision doesn't say how much it should have been. It says it was too much. It was abuse of discretion. The number that's been arrived at here, and I think it might be more appropriate for other people to respond to it, was arrived at to try to say, well, what is a reasonable figure for saying it should have been if 20% was too much?
Maybe I'm asking the wrong person this question. Like you said, we all expect legal challenges. Is the court going to be able to pick and choose, or are they going to have to say, since this piece is wrong, the whole thing's wrong? Or?
Chair Canope, Representative Barker, all of our laws that we pass out of the body are covered by a general law that deals with what's called severability. This bill actually has its very own one, just to highlight for the court the emphasis that if you find any particular piece invalid, that the rest of the bill should remain in effect.
Okay. And my concern about this is I've read other cases where people were erroneously told by a pension board, not here, that you're going to get, say, $3,500 a month retirement. And then the next day or next week they call them back and say, oh, it should have been $3,000. And the courts have said the person retired based on what you told them, pay them. And that's my concern here.
Chair Canope, Representative Barker, I don't know about other states. I do know that in Oregon that there are mistakes that were made now and then with respect to retirees. And, in fact, PERS does go back and recover those. In fact, there was a case in the paper about 6 or 12 months about a person here in Marion County who had a mistake and whose pension was significantly reduced below what he would have gotten if it had been right because he had been receiving overpayments for a period of time. And as far as I know, those are valid as long as, in fact, it's an overpayment. There was a mistake or a wrongful amount paid that you can go back and recover. I think your issue is a bigger one about the law that specifically says that there's a COLA that will be paid. Can you use the COLA mechanism to recover the overpayment? That's the approach being taken here. And the thought was that was better than taking money back out of the payments and reducing the pension amounts.
Okay, thank you very much.
Section 11 has very little in it at this point. It addresses inactive vested members, but it allows me to indicate one other piece of this relating to new hires. And that is that for new hires, once again, there will be no, under the bill, there will be no account balance. There will only be a defined benefit, which will be equal to years of service. The existing PERS structure, regular member 1.67 times years of service times final average salary. One of the issues addressed in the successor plans is if you have a purely defined benefit, what does a person who has not vested, and under PERS that means worked in each of 5 calendar years, if they leave the system, and under PERS, if you stay out for 5 years, say I work for, I'm an employee, I work for 2 years in a PERS position, and I leave. Under the existing PERS law, if I stay away from, if I don't come back into public employment within 5 years, PERS sends me a letter and says, you're out of PERS, you've lost your membership, and we will send you your account balance. Please come get it, because it's not going to earn any more interest. Well, for under the new hires here, there is no account balance, so there's nothing to send back. As it's now structured, if you fall in that scenario in the present bill, that person basically just loses whatever interest they may have had in the system. There is no account balance sent back. That person, in effect, is just out, and they lose whatever they had if they had not vested, if they're out for more than 5 years. And I'll mention in this, at this point, too, that that's the same rule now for death benefits, because the death benefit under PERS was the account balance, and there is no account balance. So unless you make it to retirement, and I think that these are things that are certainly addressed by the successor plans, because they're all aimed at new hires, but it's something that we will need, that should be returned to at some point in the successor plan, to coordinate what this bill does and whatever the eventual successor plan does. I'd like to move to section 13. As you know, employees are currently required, PERS members are currently required to make a 6% contribution of salary to the fund. And in the first couple of sections of the bill, we have now said you aren't going to be making a 6% contribution anymore. Section 13 establishes what's referred to as transition accounts. And basically, what it says is that at least for the next 2 years, until June 30th, 2003, that any public employer that was making the 6% contribution on behalf of the employer, they picked it up or assumed it. Well, I should back up. First thing it says is active members shall pay 6% of salary to these accounts. So, in effect, these accounts become the substitute for what had been the member account under PERS. So section 13 sub 1 says you shall pay 6%. Subsection 3, jumping ahead for a moment, says that any public employer that was doing the pickup, that had agreed to pay the 6% contribution on behalf of the employee under the old law, must continue to do that, make that 6% contribution until June 30th, 2003. Subsection 2 allows any public employer to agree to pick up the amount, or to make the payments on behalf of the employees. I shouldn't say pick up, but to make the payments. So in essence, what this does is lock in the 6% for at least the next 6 years, and at that point, it becomes a matter of negotiation as far as continued payments to the transition account by the employer.
Dave, did you mean for the next 2 years?
2 years, June 30th, 2005. The transition account is set up basically to act somewhat like a defined contribution plan, but I think there will need to be some adjustments to it at some point to try to acquire tax qualification for the plan. The board is directed to seek tax qualification, but at this point, I don't think we'll be able to do these on a pre-tax basis, pre-tax contribution basis by the employee.
We will or will not? We will or will not?
Will not at this point. The only way to do a pre-tax contribution is if we can do it, get it as a qualified plan, as a DC plan. We need some additional stuff to make this a DC plan. So at this point, it would not be a pre-tax contribution.
Mr. Chair,
Representative McPherson.
David, does that mean that if the contribution is made by the employer on behalf of the members as a class, then that would not be taxable to the member? So that would be pre-tax to the member. It's only if it's a member contribution paid by the member that it would not be pre-tax. Would that be a correct understanding?
Chair Knope, Representative McPherson, the transition accounts are not being set up as part of the PERS system, so I don't think there's any way it can fall underneath the tax qualification of PERS, the 401A tax qualification. That being the case, I believe you need to have a tax-qualified plan that the employer is making contributions to in order to get the pre-tax treatment.
Follow-up, if I could, Mr. Chair. But if in fact the PERS board takes the actions called for in subsection 10, of Section 13, the all actions necessary to seek qualification of the transition account program as a tax-qualified governmental retirement plan. If those actions are taken, then it would be pre-tax.
Chair, can I, if they're successful, yes, if they can get it qualified.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Barker. Could they not go into a 457G plan?
Chair, no, Representative Barker. The problem is that you're only allowed one 457 plan. My understanding is you're only allowed one 457 plan per employer, and we already have that one, deferred comp.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nolan.
You may not be the right person to ask this, and I'll defer to the PERS folks if you don't know the answer, but how quickly can we get that qualification? This is designed to take effect 2 months from today.
Chair, can I represent all? I don't know the mechanics, and I may be wrong, but in looking at ideas similar to this in the past, it may be possible to get retroactive qualification for contributions made. I'm not sure, to tell you the truth. And there will be...
Are you bringing PERS up? I'm sure they'll be here at some point.
Be happy to bring them up at your request.
for purposes, too, it should be... it's important to note that we're talking about contributions being made starting in July through the end of the year, and for most taxpayers, they need to know by April 15th of next year, but may not need, probably don't need to know on July 1st or July 2nd. But it would obviously make a difference in their choice about whether they make them, for some of them, whether it's pre-tax or not, because the pre-tax costs them basically 6% of their paycheck. Post-tax costs 7-point-something of their take-home. So it is a difference.
If I might, Mr. Chair, it is not only important for that decision, but also if the contribution is going to be made up to the same net effect, both the employee and employer need to know if they have to gross it up to get there. And so knowing the status of the fund is something they need to know before they make the first payment.
Chair, can I, Representative Miller, I presume that the payments would be treated as post-tax until there was a determination that they're pre-tax. And perhaps the PERS folks will have some idea about how long that might take, and it would be a good question for them.
Steve is busily making notes. I'm sure he'll have an answer.
Representative Barker.
Would it be possible for us to amend this so that we could use the current 457? I would suspect most people are not. I'm assuming it's not maxed out. Most people do not have that maxed out now that they've increased those numbers significantly the last year or two.
Chair Knope, Representative Barker, even those who had it maxed out, though, may not be able to do a 6% contribution because, with the limits as they are, 6%, even if you're only doing half of what you're allowed under, you probably still come up against those caps.
What are the caps now? About 30,000?
No, for state, I know on the deferred comp plan, it's like $9,500 per year.
I thought that.
25% or 9,500.
I believe there's federal legislation that passed that moves it to 30 over a period of time.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that time has come because I was in a program and it was inching its way up at $500 increments, but I believe that popped wide open here a year or so ago.
Steve might be able to shed some light on that as well.
And if there are no caps, it is actually one of the things that were discussed with respect to this provision was the possibility of just saying pop it into the 457 plan because that would be a tax-free, but there was concerns about the caps and about the ability to all members to take advantage of that. If there are no further questions on that, Section 14A addresses representation of the public employees retirement board. Like most state agencies, the public employees retirement board is required to use the attorney general's office's services. And what 14A does is basically indicate that the Attorney General, in making decisions about appointment in conflict situations, situations where there are issues relating to benefits payable under the system, that the Attorney General will consult with the governor about appointment of persons who are not Attorney Generals. Basically, the concern being here, because the Assistant Attorney Generals, Attorney General, are members of the public employees retirement system. So this is not a hugely substantial one. It ties back into existing law about appointment of separate counsel under certain circumstances. Question? No questions? Section 14B, you may remember that in House Bill 2003, as originally printed, the first four sections were aimed at remedies for the Marion County case, City of Eugene versus State of Oregon, which is currently on appeal. And Section 14B is what's left of those four sections that address what the remedy would be in those cases. And it's now clearly phrased in terms of circumstances in which the board has been required to correct one or more of the erroneous benefit calculation methods identified in that case, which means that in essence the case has to have gone up on appeal and the court has to have made a determination that in fact there was an erroneous benefit calculation done, and that there has been a direction from the court to the board to correct those errors. And Section 14B directs the board on how to recover the cost of erroneously paid benefits and tells them to do it in one or two ways, or a combination thereof, one or both of the following methods. They can either withhold cost of living increases, and that's, of course, would be in addition to the one that's already in the bill for the 1999 crediting. So this is looking at other possible orders that may come from the court relating to retirees. It could be with respect to the mortality tables. It could be with respect to the calculation of the benefit payable to people who were in the variable annuity account. That was one of the issues in the Lipscomb case about whether the board was correctly matching the amounts for those people who were in the variable annuity account. So this would be an additional direction to the board in the event the court eventually indicates that the board has to do something with respect to benefits calculations under one of the theories that are already in that case, that there would be an additional COLA adjustment. 1B, which appears on page 23 at line 26, indicates that as an alternative or as part of that remedy, that the board may treat the cost of those erroneous payments as an administrative expense of the system, which the subsection 2 specifically says that none of these costs can be treated as an employer obligation payable out of employer contributions. What this would mean is that before determining in any given year, if the board did this, if they said, okay, we have these costs that are attributable to wrongful calculations. We have to recover them somehow. The court has told us to do something about this. We will treat them as part of the administrative expenses, which means that they come off the top from any earnings in any given year. So in a year in which you have more than 0%, it would come off the top before the board then went on and did its other normal distribution to all the various things that they do, the reserve accounts, the employee, the benefit enforced reserve, the tier one reserves, all of those other things that they do. So it basically takes it off the top and uses that to to pay the cost of those errors. Questions on 14B? Again, that section is contingent upon there being a final determination, and we are assuming, and I think safely, that the court would look at what the bill does already with things like 1999 as far as determining what any remedy might be if they determine that there is in fact been a wrongful computation made with respect to benefits. Section 15 is pretty simple. It merely indicates that the board will recalculate the contribution rates for public employers to basically recoup the savings that are in here in rates starting on July 1st, 2003. I'm informed that Ways and Means adopted an amendment to 2004 this morning that does the same thing basically for all PERS bills adopted this session. So to some degree, Section 15 may become redundant. It is consistent with what they did, so it doesn't need to be removed. But I would mention that there's a general one now that applicable to that tells the board to adjust rates for all changes made to the PERS benefit structure to reflect those in the July 1st rates payable by employees. And I'll stop there.
Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it. Steve, could you come up and briefly answer Representative Nolan's questions? I'd like to get to some other testimony, and we have members of the committee who have in-district plans this evening and long ways to go. And so we're going to have to bring this to a vote here fairly shortly, but I want to give people a chance to testify if they wish to.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Delaney, legislative liaison for PERS. First, let me say we haven't looked at this question specifically, but we have looked in the past at the issues of tax qualification for PERS, and there are two issues I could share with you to give some light on this. One is we would probably need a letter, a private letter ruling from the IRS to tell us whether whatever plan we'd created was legitimate and fell within their standards. In discussions with IRS officials back in Washington, D.C. last year, they indicated that actually, at that time at least, they did not have a lot of private letter ruling requests before them. So the usual about one-year turnaround that comes behind a letter of a private letter ruling request was shorter than that. So I can tell you it'd be less than a year is about what we've heard. I would also point out that the board currently is hiring a private sector tax attorney. We were given permission by Department of Justice to work with the Ice Miller firm on dealing with the mortality issues, actual equivalency factors, so that could also come into play when we look at this language at the board doing whatever is necessary. We would be able to draw, I'm assuming, and I'm making a total assumption here at this point, upon that advice.
Okay. Can I ask another question while I see it?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Delaney, can you remind me roughly how many active Tier 1 members there are?
There are, so I think we have 140,000. We have approximately 140,000 active members, so I would say approximately 100,000 are Tier 1.
And this may be a tough one for you to know, but can you tell me approximately how many retirees have retired since January 2000, who would be affected by the COLA provisions in here?
I seem to recall, so since January 2000, we seem to have been averaging, my recollections, around 6,000 to 7,000 retirees per year. So if we're talking 3 years, we're looking at about 18,000 retirees.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pearson.
Steve, I realize this may be a little outside of your area with the agency, but are you familiar with the concept of remedial amendment rights for tax qualification? That is where a plan that's created then is filed with the IRS, and as long as the application is carried forward, when the IRS ultimately rules favorably, that ruling relates back to the inception of the plan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pearson, no, I have not dealt with that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else? Thanks, Steve. Are there any citizens in the audience that want to testify on this particular bill? Come on up, sir. We have a limited amount of time, but I do want to give you an opportunity to put your comments on the record. We'll leave the record on this open for those who want to submit written testimony until Wednesday of next week.
Yeah, for the record, my name is Steve Johnston. I'm a retired state employee. I have a wife who quit when I quit, 25-year state employee. The way I read this is that come when she goes to retire, the odds are her account balance will not increase in the next 5.5 years when she can retire, because there will be no earnings putting up the deficit. She's going to be hit by the new mortality tables, which will be less money yet. I will be hit by no cost of living raises, but on the same standpoint, my Kaiser insurance premium went from $630 to $730 a month. So the costs are going up. When my wife retired or quit, when I quit, we received things from PERS that basically said if you quit at a certain date, at the first of the year, your pension would be such and such at age 58. If you worked, your estimate pension would be a different figure. That was based on the 8% increase of our every year that was in the law. My mental calculations, real quick, say my wife's probably going to get about half of what she would get in 5.5 years. That means that she would have to go back to work. I've had a bout of kidney cancer, and my wife doesn't want to go back to work right now. That's one of the reasons that she's not working. And it just seems that we rely very heavily on PERS statements, the 8%, the mortality tables, and they're all hitting, and you're doing so much at once. You're not taking a small increment from some people. You're taking a very large increment of what we thought was a promise and what we relied upon. When I saw that they passed a bill, and I think it was the first bill that Governor Kulongoski passed, that basically said we're going to create the 8% as a maximum until the deficit was paid off, I thought that's very reasonable because we were guaranteed the 8%. She'll get what she was promised, and she won't get a 9, 10, or 11, 12%. But we can't afford to have pensions literally cut in half by saying in 5 years from now your account balance is not going to have increased, your mortality tables have been changed, and by the way, you're not going to get the cost of living increases, but we're not going to do anything to help with the enormous increase in the retirees' health insurance. It's not right, it's not fair, and I think you should be looking at little bits, not a massive thing, that literally are going to destroy the financial planning of many thousands of people. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other citizens? Any other group, organizations want to come forward? Brian?
For the record, Brian DeLashman, representing the Oregon Nurses Association, the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, and the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. I'm clearing off the tire treads off the top of my head right now. I see the train coming. I have to put on the record that we are strongly opposed to 2003 for a variety of reasons that you're well aware of. Well, let me talk to you a little bit about, you just heard from a gentleman that talked about specifics of his particular case. Let me give you an example of the types of emails and letters that I'm getting. Nurse works for Multnomah County, has worked there 42 years. A nurse that works 42 years in Multnomah County emails me and says, should I retire? What are they going to do to my retirement? She doesn't want to retire. She is now under this. There is absolutely no doubt that she's going to retire. Went fishing with the director of Fish and Wildlife last week. He's got an employee, one of his administrative staff. Said, great worker. One of the best workers that he could imagine having. somebody that takes work home on weekends and nights. She has no other life other than her work. She is now turning in her paperwork. These are the types of people we're losing with this rush to make a correction that we believe inevitably is going to be overturned. That leads me to my next point. I think the real concern that I have is that this is going to be almost impossible to unravel after we do it. I think when the courts rule on this a year down the road or 14 months down the road, we're going to have a situation in which we're going to have to go back individually, one by one, through each person who's been impacted, whether they're a retiree or an active member, and make them whole. And I think making them whole is not just giving them the money back that they would have had in their account or they would have had as a retiree. I think, in fact, there is additional making of whole, as I understand the remedy under the breach of contract, and that's more than the actual amount. So any concept or any precept that no harm, no foul, we can always, if it's overturned, make it up to people without any additional cost to the state and local government, I think is a fallacy. I think this will in fact make 3349 look like a little blip. If you recall, 3349 was the taxing issue. I think this is going to be a major problem, and unfortunately I think this is going to hit us about mid biennium, and it's going to be a situation in which we're not going to have the resources, local government's not going to have the resources, and the state's not going to have the resources to make people whole. And I have a real concern about what impact that has on the services in this state. And with that, I'll answer any questions. I just didn't want to leave any doubt in anybody's mind. People who I represent are as against this as any bill that I've ever seen come in front of the legislature.
Any questions? Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you. We're going to, I think, go ahead and recess committee. And I believe we're going to track down one more member in the governor's office. And then we'll get started again. So we'll recess for about 5 to 10 minutes until we can pick up that member. House Committee on PERS. And Representative Scott, we were just finishing up with some public testimony and looking for a motion on the Dash 6 amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
I move the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2003.
Representative Brown has moved the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2003. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
On the amendments?
The amendments are the bill, aren't they?
Representative Nolan.
Thank you. I have been trying to keep up with all the developments on this bill, and I appreciate Mr. Hendricks' review of it. It is still an enormous piece of legislation, both in actual volume and certainly in financial impact, that makes me hesitant to vote unless I know exactly how it will be played out and whether how it will affect public policy as well as contracts that the state is obligated to. But in essence, one of the anxieties I have with the amendments, with a quick calculation using the information that Mr. Delaney gave me, this legislature has already enacted bills that will reduce the unfunded liability in PERS by almost $2.5 billion. And those savings are accrued by reducing the benefits of some 118,000 workers. A quick calculation tells me that we're asking those Oregonians to each contribute $20,000 on average to help the state provide services to all 3.5 million of us. I think that's a lot to ask them to do. I supported one of those bills, and I think it's very aggressive but reasonable for our public employees at the state and local level to chip in at that level. But this bill, as I understand it, takes another $7 billion from roughly those same 118,000 people to benefit services that all 3.5 million of us get. And by my calculation, that's asking them to contribute another $60,000 each for services that we all benefit from. And I can't see my way to asking them to chip in when the rest of us aren't.
Is that it?
That's it.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, I think we all understand the magnitude of what's being done here, and I would like to just add my feelings of this, the severity of this, but also try and put the perspective that I'm glad this House Bill 2003 does have the floor indicating that although these adjustments are being made, that the workers will not be receiving less than the 8% annual accrued benefit, which was the underlying figure for a 40-year average investment return. And to say that those that were given a windfall that was never anticipated in this retirement plan that's been in place for all these years, that they're now having their money taken from them, is like saying that a bank account that was accredited a large sum of money that was not anticipated by the depositor and then ultimately has to give that back, although not in lump sum, but over a period of time, that somehow they're losing their money. There was a strange concatenation of events that took place in the late 90s that resulted in the over-allocation of funds to these accounts. And this is the fairest way that any of us have been able to see to allow those that have their benefits and have been planning their lives around those benefits will be able to retain what they're getting presently, and then over time get back closer to where their anticipated retirement should have been based on a retirement plan that guarantees 8%.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to start off by thanking you for doing this whole process. I've heard you say on a number of times this mess was not caused by the public employees, and I think that needs to be said. This has so far been my least fun day of political life. And, you know, as we talk about these cuts, we're going to reduce that, as these teachers, we're seeing the teachers, and especially the teachers and school employees, are facing cuts of days of employment. Their final average salaries are dropping. So when they get there, those who are going to retire this year and next year are going to be hit with lower than average salaries, lower than their salary should have been, the pay freezes and so on, the days that are cut. And I have a great deal of sympathy for that. We're putting a lot of weight on the backs of the school employees and the teachers over this thing. I'm worried about, as we go to the future, that a police or firefighter who retires at age 55 and won't be able to draw full Social Security until 67 has a long time to go between the day they leave service and the day they're able to get the other piece of their retirement that we've talked about as being hurt. When I saw these amendments today, -6 amendments, the preamble gave me a great deal of heartache, and I understand, I think, why it's in there to try to lay out the court case, but I wish we could have left that out. It would be if Mr. DeLashman had said, I have a preamble that Greg Hartman wrote, how about putting that in? I would have said no to that. And so I just think that kind of is an unnecessary tip of the balance. We're going to require our public employees to carry quite a burden on this, restoring PERS to some kind of retirement plan. And a large part of that has been caused by the huge thefts by corporate CEOs that have really put Wall Street in the tank. We shouldn't forget that. And one other thing I would say, while we talk about the savings, it's my opinion that as a responsible fiduciary position, we ought to escrow those savings, because this is going to court. If it gets overturned, let's have the money on hand to deal with it at that time and not have to then dig into a new hole. I was tempted to vote no because I have a lot of problems with this today, but it would be more of a symbolic vote because we're going to have to do something about PERS. The train is leaving the station, clearly, today. And I want to get that train on the track and rolling and get it across the street to the courthouse as quickly as we can to get this resolved for everybody's benefit. And with that, I'll be quiet. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Brown.
You know, in my relatively short legislative career, and with this vote, it might get a great deal shorter, but the... this is probably undoubtedly one of the toughest votes any of us will take in our career in this building. I don't feel that any of us truly want to hurt our state employees, but I was elected to represent all the people in my district and all the people in the state of Oregon. And this PERS debacle is affecting and hurting all of the people in the state of Oregon. And so I feel I have a responsibility to also look at and care for those people's demands and needs. And I'm not looking forward to this vote, but I feel it is my responsibility to act responsible, and that will require me supporting this measure.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's, in preparation for this vote, it's useful to think about what's happened over the last 8 years in this country. We had a classic speculative bubble in the stock market. We had 4 or 5 years that were where the markets were surging upward at what we now know were unsustainable levels, followed by a classic collapse in the markets. And what that did to people in most retirement plans, certainly any 401k or other retirement plan, is they saw their account surge upward and then collapse, and many people have experienced a 30%, a 40%, a 50% decline in their retirement savings. Within the PERS system, the people who are in the variable account experience just that same dynamic. They saw their accounts zoom upward and then collapse backward. Within the Tier 1 Regular accounts, however, what we saw was accounts go rapidly upward with what we know now were unsustainable and inappropriate crediting rates, and then drop back just to an 8% guaranteed level. I think it's useful to look at what happened in the accounts over that four-year period. In 1996, the actual return on assets was 24.4%, and 21% was credited. That is 13% over the guaranteed rate. In 1997, 20.4% actual return, of which 18.7% was credited. 98, 15.4, out of which 14.1 was credited. And in 1999, 24.9, out of which 20% was credited. We know now, with benefit of hindsight, that was an improvident thing to do, to credit those kinds of rates. And now we have a system that is burdened by the consequences of that poor judgment. Now, I had a long conversation on the telephone last evening with a teacher in my district who lives in Lake Oswego and teaches in the Lake Oswego Public Schools. Now, her particular situation is she's approaching retirement, and she went 75% into the variable account. So she's seeing an account which mainly had what zoomed upward and then collapsed. It's only the 25% piece that received these the credits that I was just describing. And she's distraught because it's coming at her in several ways. The regular portion of her account, that quarter, is going to suffer as a result of the changes that we're considering today, assuming that we have passed them out. As a teacher, she's looking at a pay freeze and the all the limitations within the school district that are going to impact on her pay and benefits. And as a resident and taxpayer in the city of Lake Oswego, she's going to be asked by the school district to pay more in either income taxes, property taxes, or both in a local effort to fund the local schools beyond what is being provided by the state. So I think that her situation is kind of a microcosm of the tensions we have here. She suffered hugely in the big upsurge in the market and the collapse. And then she's going to suffer again in her capacity as a public employee and as a taxpayer in the fallout of that. The solution we have before us, the proposals, are wrenching decisions for us to make. But they are decisions in which we are dealing with the consequences that a lot of other people have suffered through in their own way. And now those consequences of a speculative market have fallen on our Tier 1 employees, and I think it's a darn shame. But in order to support our public services the way they need to be done, this is a very difficult thing to do, but it's something that I think we must do, and so I'm going to vote yes.
Representative Scott.
Well, although I wasn't here for the majority of the presentation, I had been briefed on it, and I think I followed it. I, like the rest of you, painfully take this vote today, and I think that the state employees are deserving of everything that we possibly can do. I like Representative Brown, feel that we also have to we have an obligation to the remainder of the citizens of the state, and I sympathize with the remarks that have been made and to the folks that this directly affects in both ways. I think that there's some truism to what's caused the stock market to affect this, and I also think it's part of just the cyclatory things that we do go through. And as Representative McPherson said, we probably, hindsight's 20/20, and we made some wrong decisions, or decisions were made incorrectly as to the amount that was contributed. This isn't comfortable, but I do think it's the right thing for us to move forward.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank the governor for reaching out in bipartisanship and working on this bill with us. This is a bipartisan plan. It is the culmination of work from many very, I think, astute and intelligent people in this chamber, from both sides of the aisle, the executive branch, legislative branch. And this is what we believe that we could come up with that was as fair as we could do with trying to put the genie back in the bottle that was released during the mid-90s that has, I think, it led us to the situation. I think this will be the most difficult vote that everybody has to make in this chamber, and it's going to have a great effect. We all know that, but we also know that if we do nothing, we're going to fail. So I would prefer to do something and try to give the court some options, some remedies to fix this problem. I would remind people that the PERS plan is 66% funded, which means if you are near the end of Tier 1 or in Tier 2, there isn't the money to pay your benefits when you retire, which is a problem. And if we don't fix it, the taxpayers will not vote themselves a tax increase to pay the benefits that no one intended people to receive. I don't think that even public employees believe they're going to receive more than 100% of their retirement when they signed up 25 years ago, 30 years ago. And even though that's a small number of people now, we all know that that number grows and tops out at about 200% in the next 20 years if we do nothing. And we'll never make it there because the state will be in bankruptcy. Every district in the state will be in bankruptcy probably within two or three years because they won't be able to afford their PERS costs. They really can't afford them now, but they can't afford a doubling of them in the next 10 years, and that's essentially what is going to happen. So recognizing all of that, recognizing the seriousness of this vote, I'd like to thank the members of the committee for their hard work. And with that, is there any objection to the Dash 6 Amendment? Let's call the roll on Dash 6 Amendment.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Butler?
Excused.
Representative Corey?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
No.
Representative Richardson?
Aye.
Representative Scott?
Aye.
Chair Knoop?
Aye. The Dash 6 Amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
I move House Bill 2003 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded.
Thank you, Representative Brown. Representative Brown has moved House Bill 2003 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representative Butler. Representative Corey.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative Nolan.
No.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Chair Knoop.
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 2003 will move to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. The chair will carry. Thank you. We're going to close the work session on House Bill 2003. And if there's nothing else for the good of the committee, committee is adjourned.